under the Chronicler's control. Honestly, I'm not sure why anyone listens to him. Of all the people who could become emperor, why him? She looked at him curiously.
Do you know why the emperor died?
He had some suspicions, but he didn't voice them. I was never sure, no.
He was losing his mind,
she said.
He kept the heart of Nekothi at bay for more than 1,500 years, but he could not resist the dead mother when she began to awaken. So he was killed. I suspect he allowed it, but I cannot prove it. However, it is true that with him gone, the elders are more active than ever. If no one directs the empire as a whole, civilization will disappear bit by bit.
Not for the first time, Calder remembered Nabarius' expression as he cradled Nekothi's heart. There has to be a better choice. For some reason, she waved her arms in the air as though chasing away invisible butterflies.
Whomever we select for the throne is going to be taken by the elders eventually, but better someone like Nabarius than no one at all.
Calder stood for a moment, absorbed in his thoughts. He was still having trouble picturing Nabarius at the head of the global empire, but when she put it that way, maybe he was the best man for the job. If the throne was really a sentence of insanity and death, then the Chronicler might deserve it. But he couldn't escape the thought that he was missing some crucial piece of the picture. Why did simply being in charge of the Aurelian Empire make him so vulnerable to corruption? Wouldn't it be the heart? But Bliss spoke as though the authority itself put him at risk.
It surprises me that you are so concerned about Nabarius' rule as emperor,
Bliss said after a moment.
I thought you'd be more worried about his plots to have you killed.
The words echoed in Calder's mind, but it took him a few seconds to hear their meaning. Please, go on. The Blackwatch Guildhead tapped herself lightly on the forehead.
Ah, that's right. You didn't know because I was going to tell you.
A fist hammered on the cabin door. Time's up, Captain, the guard called in. Lord Claiborne needs you on deck.
Nabarius Claiborne is going to call you and your entire crew on deck, where he will have you executed. He seems to think that he is preventing an eventual rebellion.
She pinched his blanket, lifting it up to examine it.
You should invest in some nice soft sheets. A good night's sleep is healthy for the human body.
Calder stilled his shaking hands as he raced through all the possibilities. Urzaiah. He needed Urzaiah. If the champion could keep the men off him, then Calder could eject them all from the ship. But they knew that. They would have taken precautions for the two registered soulbound on the crew. Maybe Foster could do something, or Andal. The Imperial Guard rapped on the door again, calling his name, and Bliss reached up to pat him on the head.
You should be calm now. I am here. Hush, baby. Hush.
Did you just call me a baby?
It is what mothers do to calm their children. Are you calmed?
Not exactly, but he did feel a little better. He'd almost forgotten that Bliss was on board. With her on their side, his crew had an actual chance of survival.
I suggest you escape as soon as possible,
Bliss said. It would go much more smoothly if we had your help. Rather, if she didn't help, they might as well feed themselves to the Lyathaton. She considered that for a moment.
That's possible. Well then, farewell until I see you again, Calder Martin.
She opened the chest again and started to climb in. Sweat crawled down his skin. Bliss, please tell me that you're going to take care of this. Bliss? Guildhead? Please, answer me. She put a finger over her lips, signaling silence, and then pulled the lid of the chest shut. Chapter 17. A true champion of the Champions Guild is more than just a soulbound. The champions are raised from an early age on an abusive regimen of training and actual combat. They are taught nothing but battle, raised to believe that victory is the only virtue. Along the way, they are subject to a battery of alchemical treatments to increase their physical and mental attributes. Most of the children do not survive, but the survivors emerge with incredible gifts. I doubt the ethics of such a system, but I cannot doubt its results. From the official report of the witness assigned to the Champions Guild. Present day. Urzaiah Woodsman sat in the hold of the Testament, surrounded by barrels, crates, and bundles of cargo. He should have been cooking, he knew. They were about to leave, and they had all these extra passengers on board. If he were doing his duty, he would have food ready for them before they thought to ask for it. But instead, he sat with his legs crossed and his hatchets in his lap, breathing deeply. It had been a long time since he'd fallen into this habit of his. Before each match in the arena, he had sat and calmed himself, focusing, stripping away hesitation and thought, a practice they'd taught him as a fighter of the Champions Guild. It was ingrained in him after so many years. Whenever he felt that he should prepare for a fight, he would sink into this state. And now, here he was. A battle was coming. The chronicler, Nabarius, he smiled too much, and the captain hadn't spoken of it, but Urzaya was sure that the man had killed his own Silent One. Now Andal and the captain had been invited to another navigator's vessel to meet with Nabarius' mysterious backers, and while they were gone, the Imperial Guard had begun to invade the Testament. Urzaya didn't hold a grudge against the guards. They were trying to earn a living, same as anyone. But they were too tense, too off guard, for this to really be an inspection as they claimed. He'd invited one of them for a drink, and the other man had brushed him off immediately. Why would someone not want to drink with Urzaya? He could imagine only two possibilities. Either the guard's mind had been poisoned by the elders, or a battle was coming. So Urzaya found himself in the hold, cross-legged and clearing his mind. When the door crashed open, he was not surprised. He slowly opened his eyes and favored the pair of strangers with a smile.
"Welcome, my friends. Have you come to take that drink after all?"
These two were bigger than the average guard. One of them stood half a head over Urzaya himself, such that he had to bow deeply to slip through the doorframe. He had gray plates growing out of his skin until it looked as though he were wearing an actual suit of dull armor. Urzaya recognized the plates of a planestrider from his homeland. His partner had replaced one hand with the claw of a strange chimera, bright red and spiked like a venomous insect's fangs. In his human hand, he carried a sack that clanked with a ring of steel. The armored man wore a pistol and a Delian hunting knife. The other, just a pistol. Urzaya didn't move from his seat. He'd lived through this situation many times before. The plated man would say something to get his attention, then the venomous one would slash at him to try and weaken him. If he intended to start with a shot from his pistol, then he'd have been holding the sack with the other hand. That meant he wanted his chimera hand free, not his weapon. To his surprise, the man with the red hand sighed and sat his sack down. It rang as it hit the ground as though it had been filled with chimes. "We're just supposed to keep you down here for a while," he said, pulling out a flask from his chest pocket. "The guild head was worried that you'd get fidgety and put us all in the ocean." The guard took a sip first, to show that it was safe, then handed it over to Urzaya. Well, it would be rude to refuse, and the man had taken a drink for himself. Urzaya accepted, tilting the flask up to his lips. They would have been suspicious if he didn't drink at all, though it could easily be poisoned. Some guards had a resistance to poison, and everyone knew it was easier to kill a champion through assassination rather than in battle. Well, of course it was easier. It was impossible to kill a champion in battle.
"Now, why would I fidget?" Urzaya asked. "What is happening on the deck that would make me nervous?"
The plated guard looked over at his partner, but the man with the clawed hand just took his flask back.
"Nothing, nothing. I swear on the Emperor's name. It's just an inspection before Lord Claiborne comes aboard." "You are serving the witnesses now, then?" Urzaya asked curiously.
The armored man's eyes widened behind the plates covering his face.
"You don't know. Nabarius Claiborne will be the next emperor."
Urzaya had kept a fake smile all this time. Now it became genuine. The battle was almost here. If the guards believed Nabarius was the next emperor, then there was nothing they wouldn't do to protect him. And Nabarius had no particular reason for trusting the Testament's crew. Urzaya reached out his left arm toward the red-clawed guard.
"You may scratch me," he said.
The two guards froze.
"Your job was to poison and bind me, wasn't it? And then perhaps to kill me after?"
None of them moved.
"I accept your terms. Scratch me."
Tentatively, the guard extended one red claw and drew a bloody line down Urzaya's forearm.
"Very good," Urzaya said. "Now, take your chains and tie me."
He nodded toward the abandoned sack. The armored guard slowly pulled the chain out of the sack, followed by a padlock.
"These are invested, you know. They will keep down your strength,"
Urzaya snorted.
"I hope so. Otherwise, I will snap them like..."
He thought for a moment.
"Like I would snap ordinary chains."
The poison was already swimming through him. He could feel it, and he could feel the heat flowing through him, from the tips of his fingers through his chest, tingling at the back of his neck. The familiar strength that came as the forces bound within his body rose to the fight.
"Emperor's name, I have missed that feeling."
He sat without resistance as they wrapped chains around him and took away his hatchets. He almost broke out right there when he saw them take his weapons, but he forced himself to relax. They treated the weapons with respect anyway, carrying them each in a different hand and placing them reverently on top of a nearby crate. Urzaya was grateful. It wouldn't hurt them too badly. The red-clawed man let out a breath of pure relief as he snapped the padlock shut. Then he backed off, his hands shaking. It seemed that he had believed Urzaya was going to attempt to break out and now felt the danger was past. He was wrong. There would be no attempting. Urzaya smiled at the two of them.
"So, what is the plan now, my friends?"
They exchanged a glance, hesitating.
"I saw you in the arena," the red-clawed guard said. "You fought like a madman." "Yes, I did," Urzaya said.
The two guards drew their guns, and Urzaya rolled chained shoulders. The poison fuzzed his vision at the edges and clouded his thoughts. The chains seemed unnaturally cold wherever they brushed his skin, drawing the energy from his muscles. The wound on his arm itched and burned. He looked up into the two barrels and thought,
"At last, a fair fight." "I'm sorry," the guard said.
Focusing on the gold-scaled hide wrapped around his arm, Urzaya unleashed his vessel. The strength and fury of the sand-born Hydra filled him, blinding him entirely, filling him until he felt that his skin would pop, tightening his muscles as though they would tear themselves apart. The wood under him creaked under a sudden weight. The guards both pulled their triggers. The rage boiled out of Urzaya in a wordless roar. Two bullets stung him, one in the left of his chest, just below his heart, the other at the base of his neck. Like stinging insects, they inflicted a little annoyance, but no pain. Vaguely, he noticed crumpled balls of lead falling away from his undamaged skin. But they had tried to hurt him. They had tried to kill him. They had dared to lie to him, and they hadn't bothered to lie well. They deserved their pain, and he wasn't going to let anyone take it from them. And now, at last, he would finally get his hands on an enemy. The consultants were the ones who had truly earned his wrath, but the anger of the sand-born Hydra didn't care. Two enemies were within his grasp, so those were the enemies that would pay. The armored guard opened his mouth to shout for help, but Urzaya's hand snapped up and threw the chain, tearing it like a cobweb. His hand closed over the man's mouth. One of the links from the torn chain struck against the boards overhead and fell to the ground.
"No screaming," Urzaya said, still smiling.
He raised his second hand, grabbing the other side of the guard's organic helmet and slowly squeezing his fingers together. The Chimera plate armor squealed and stressed beneath his grip. The red-clawed guard raked at his back, trying to deliver another dose of venom. This time, Urzaya was ready for him. He was filled with power and rage, such that nothing could pierce him, nothing could damage him. Claws slid down his skin like chalk. He tossed the armored guard aside, catching a raised red hand in one of his own. He leaned in to look at the red-clawed guard from only inches away, speaking into the man's sweat-drenched face.
"You get to live," he said.
Then he slammed a fist into the man's ribs, lifted him, and tossed him deeper into the hold. Urzaya spun to catch the attack that he knew would be coming from the back. It had been years, but he could almost feel the arena sand beneath his bare feet, the weight of the sun on his back. The pattern was so simple he could read it more easily than any book. He held out his hands to stop a strike that didn't come. The armored guard still lay motionless on the ground, breathing harsh and labored. He wasn't dead, and for a brief moment, Urzaya's anger almost drowned him. If he wasn't dead, then he should be up and fighting. And if he wasn't up and fighting, then he should be dead. Urzaya raised one foot to crush the man's head, drawing on the sandborn Hydra's power to increase his weight. The boards beneath his foot creaked again, but he hesitated.
Not me, he thought. This is the Hydra.
He forced his raised foot back down, pushing the Hydra's anger away. No matter how many times he fought in the arena, his greatest opponent was always his own soulbound vessel. The guild had given him many gifts other than his power as a soulbound, but the Hydra was his most powerful weapon, and his oldest, never defeated enemy. He pushed the urges of the Hydra to the back of his mind, reaching over and picking up his two awakened hatchets. The captain and the others should be in danger on deck. The Imperial Guards wouldn't have attacked down here if their brothers and sisters didn't have the rest of the crew well in hand. The gunshots would give them away otherwise. In the last fight on the Testament's deck, Urzaya had been humiliated. A mere poison had brought him low so quickly that he hadn't had time to call upon the Hydra's power. His alchemical enhancements had eventually neutralized the potion, but it was too late for the fight, too late for Jirene. This time he would not shame himself. The captain would not regret giving him his freedom. With a black hatchet in each hand, Urzaya marched up to the deck. He was calm. He was always calm just before he stepped into the arena. The champion took a deep, satisfied breath of the sea air.
What a wonderful day!
As Calder stepped out of his cabin and saw his entire crew clustered around the mast, surrounded by Imperial guards, he tried to appear casual. He turned to the scaled guard who stood outside his cabin. I'm sorry, guardsman, but what's going on here? Has my crew done something wrong? Surreptitiously, he brushed the back of his hand against the railing. He read the ship, searching for the one crew member missing, Urzaya. The former champion was beneath, sitting peacefully on the ground as two guards wrapped him in chains. What was he doing? Had they drugged him somehow? Safety of the future emperor, the guard was saying when Calder came out of the reader's trance. If you would join your crew, please, so we can see that everyone is accounted for. Calder slowly walked over to the others, taking stock of the situation. Andal's suit was stained, his hat was missing, and they had taken his white sun pendant, in case he was an unregistered soulbound, presumably. Petal shivered and hugged herself, hiding her face in the veil of her hair. No change there. Foster sat with his back against the mast, grumbling into his beard. He wore his shooting glasses, with his reading glasses still dangling against his chest, but they had managed to get his guns away from him. Where's Urzaya? Calder asked, as though he had just noticed.
He caused a scene, said one of the guards. We had to have him confined below deck.
A roar echoed up from the heart of the ship. Just then, a shot rang out, echoing from the depths of the vessel, or maybe several shots overlapping. Calder let himself fall against the mast, reaching through it with his reader's senses to get a feel for the ship. He wanted to laugh. Urzaya was toying with the two guards like a cat with a pair of mice. He shook off the trance early and glanced over at the other ship, drifting a few dozen yards away. Red and black uniforms had clustered on the side of the deck closest him, and they all seemed to be clutching muskets in their hands, claws, or talons. The guards on this deck had all conveniently arranged themselves so they happened to be out of the line of fire. Only a single figure on the other ship stood out. One man with flowing dark hair, a broad grin, and a red suit. The scaled guard took Calder roughly by the arm, shoving his back against the mast. One of his hands rummaged around Calder's hip and jacket, looking for his pistol. Calder held it out between two fingers, waving it around while making it clear that he wasn't going to pull the trigger. He called over to the Eternal.
Nabarius, once I'm dead, I thought you might want my pistol.
Nabarius laughed, shouting back,
Is that so? Is it worth collecting?
The guard froze in reaching for the pistol, hesitating now that the future Emperor had actually responded. Calder grabbed the gun by its barrel and stared at his gunner.
It's a Dalton Foster original.
He tossed the pistol overhand. As the gun sailed through the air, Calder silently pleaded that nothing would go wrong. The guards would hesitate, the bullet wouldn't fall out of the barrel in midair, and Foster would take his meaning. In that meandering second while the gun hung in the air, a familiar weight settled on his shoulder.
Oh good, Shuffles is here, Calder thought, as tentacles brushed his cheek. So, it thinks we're going to die.
Dalton Foster went from grumbling and staring at the deck to a shooting crouch in the blink of an eye. He snatched the pistol from the air without looking, firing instantly into the feathered chest of a nearby guard, then stood. As the guard fell, he pulled that man's pistol from its holster and leveled it at another. The rest of the crew exploded into action at the same moment. Andal elbowed his captor in the nose with the back of his head. It did nothing because the woman holding him had a beak, but he managed to stumble his way over to the far side of the mast, where fire from the other deck wouldn't reach him. Calder ducked and slipped out of the scaly guard's grip, fumbling at the hilt of the man's sword, trying to pull the saber free. As he did, he noticed Petal scrambling for freedom. That was a relief. She was no fighter. Over on the Eternal, someone yelled,
Fire!
Everyone on the Testament lunged for cover. Everyone except for Urzaya Woodsman. The Azirian gladiator burst from the hold, shouting, shrugging off musket shots. He plowed into a guard with his shoulder, sending the man hurtling over the railing and into the water. Urzaya threw a hatchet with each hand, burying one blade in the back of Andal's captor and the other into the side of Calder's scaled guard. Those scales managed to deflect the hatchet somewhat, but he couldn't stop the awakened blade entirely. He grunted, blood leaking down his side, staggering back to look at his wound. And Calder managed to get the man's saber free. Many of the guards had discarded their pistols in favor of swords, either because they didn't have time to reload or because they thought the blades would do more against Urzaya. They were mistaken. Blades smacked against Urzaya's bare skin and did no more damage than if they'd cut him on his hardened leather breastplate. He barreled into the first guard, a man who tried to cling to the Azirian with his oversized eagle talons. Urzaya peeled him off, leaped closer to the side of the deck, and hurled his opponent straight into the water. A musket ball buzzed past Calder's ear, stopping him from watching any further. A guard leveled his pistol from a few feet away as another volley erupted from the other boat, pointing his gun at Calder's chest. Inches from his face, Shuffles laughed maliciously. Calder had managed to get a saber, but he couldn't fight like this. If the fire from the other deck continued, then his crew had virtually no chance of escaping with their lives. He either had to figure out a way to take out the guards on the other ship, or... Calder collapsed to his knees, avoiding the shot from the nearest guard's pistol. His injured leg screamed in protest. He placed both of his hands against the deck, reading. The ship yearns to fight against the intruders on its deck. It was made to fight, not to sit passively by, but it can't move on its own. It wants Calder to call it to action so that it can fight beside its crew. Calder let his intent flow into the wood, giving orders to his vessel. And without warning, the ship listed hard to starboard. The deck tilted, water and cargo sliding down toward the starboard rail. A guard lost his footing, sliding closer to the ocean, only to be stopped by a tentacle from one of his comrades. Everyone stumbled equally. Foster missed a shot. Andal had to hug the mast to avoid falling, and Urzaya used the slope to slide down closer to another guard, knocking him off his feet and slamming a hatchet into the bridge of his nose. Unsteady footing could not stop a champion. But most importantly, the port side had risen, blocking off musket fire. The only part of the Eternal still visible was the top of its mast and its bright red sails. A guard grabbed Calder by the shoulders, trying to stabilize himself, and Calder ran him through with his stolen saber. The body slid off, and another guard walked up. This one had huge, clawed feet that gouged into the deck as he marched closer, not put off at all by the awkward angle. His blade was broad and thick, and he stood head and shoulders above Calder. So Calder didn't fight him. He tucked his mind back into his soul-bound vessel, calling on the Testament's power, and grabbed the man with a coil of rope. The rope hurled the guard, screaming, over to the Eternal. Shuffles flew off of Calder's shoulder, flapping in midair, mimicking the guard's scream and combining it with triumphant laughter. The guard had a better chance of survival if he landed in the ocean rather than on the deck, but Calder didn't care where the man ended up. Another guard had fallen down in front of Calder from a perch on the mast, brandishing a saber in each taloned hand. She struck with both swords in rapid succession, trying to force Calder back so that she could break through his guard. Calder didn't back up. He knocked the first blade aside, then the second, and then he stabbed the woman just under her collarbone. She folded up, groaning instead of screaming, and slid along the deck down the port side. She wore a comical expression of shock and surprise. Petal edged out from the door to Calder's cabin, eyes wide.
"Captain, you dueled an Imperial Guard, and you won."
Calder kept an eye out for more enemies, but most of them were focusing on Urzaya. Foster and Andal had managed to hide behind the big soulbound, occasionally taking shots of their own, but mostly hiding until the Azirian cleaned up. "I'm a highly trained duelist, Petal." She hid her eyes behind her hair.
"But you never fight."
He reminded himself this was Petal. She could have missed or forgotten details that he thought were obvious, so he kept his reply gentle.
"I'm afraid you're mistaken. I fight all the time."
"Well, you sort of use ropes. And the ship. And guns. And sometimes you run and hide."
"You can't wave your sword around all the time," Calder said, waving his sword around. "It's not tactically sound."
Andal hurried over, breathing hard, a few bleeding cuts marring his white shirt. Somewhere he'd found his hat.
"I saw that you managed to win a fight, sir. Well done."
Calder leaned forward and wiped the blood from his blade on Andal's shirt, leaving long smears of red on the white.
"Why does everyone seem surprised when they say that?"
"I think I speak for everyone when I say we expected you to run away,"
Andal responded. He reached out to a broken quick lamp, letting the leaking liquid flow over his fingers. Then he clapped Calder in the back of the head. Thick, lukewarm liquid began to run down Calder's neck.
"I use a variety of tactics," Calder said, shrugging his shoulders to try and catch the alchemical oil with the back of his jacket. "It was Sedestines who first said, in most of life, to fight is to lose."
"Cowards everywhere bow to your expertise, sir."
Shuffles returned, landing on the top of his head this time.
"Coward."
Though they were in the midst of battle, Calder sighed. Across the deck, Urzaya laughed as he kicked the last Imperial Guard into the Aeon, leaving only bodies and the groaning wounded still on deck. He turned to Calder, his scarred face practically glowing.
"What now, Captain?"
Calder considered for only a moment. If they left now, Gerilis Teach would catch up on her bird and kill them all. They had only one chance, and it was recklessly risky.
"This will teach them to call me a coward."
"Foster,"
he said, and reached out a hand. The gunner wordlessly placed a pistol into his open palm.
"Urzaya, you and I will be headed over to the Eternal, where we will take Nabarius hostage. Once we have him, we can negotiate our safe passage out of here."
The woodsman shouted out another laugh.
"Wonderful! Can you make the jump?"
"No, I'm a human being."
Calder reached out and pushed a hand against the mast, once again reaching his intent down into the ship, through the chains, and to the Lyathaton.
There is a commotion among the tiny beings above. If it goes on for another cycle of the stars and moon, the Lyathaton may decide to get involved. But there are dangerous tools on the other wooden vessel, and it is wary.
Calder sends his orders, and the Elder agrees with a mixture of reluctance, old resignation, and tireless wrath. He clutched a saber in his right hand and a pistol in his left, and he sent another message to the ship. Without warning, the ship corrected itself, crashing down to port until it floated evenly in the water once again. As soon as the port side bobbed down, Calder ran and jumped onto the railing, launching himself into the air.
Chapter 18.
present day. Urzaiah jumped a moment after Calder, but he launched himself with the force of a wind watcher bursting into the air. He soared in an arc that would take him directly to the Eternal's deck, clutching a black hatchet in each hand. Calder, on the other hand, jumped off the railing and started falling toward the ocean. The Leviathan caught him. Its blue, six-fingered, webbed hand burst from the dark surface of the water, rising up beneath Calder's boots. He stumbled but managed to remain standing, despite the shock of pain that ran up the cut in his leg. He forced himself to run across the pliant surface of the palm, vaulting off one of the fingers. With that boost, he was able to make it to the dark red deck of Cheska Bennett's ship. The Imperial Guard reacted, but they were torn between facing Urzaiah, defending against Calder, and protecting themselves from what they assumed was an Elder attack. Some of them rushed to the rail, some of them lowered guns at Urzaiah, and only a few of them took a menacing step toward Calder. Only two stood in front of Nabarius, one defending him with a scorpion's tail and the other with ominous metal claws. So they weren't prepared when Urzaiah barreled through the first layer of guards, smashing his way straight to Nabarius. Calder ran through the highway his cook had cleared, panting and desperately hoping that none of the guards would snatch him up before he reached the chronicler. Nabarius had managed to pull out a pistol by the time Urzaiah had him in hand, one hatchet pressed to his throat. For the sake of redundancy, Calder pulled his own gun, pressing it to the future Emperor's head.
"Good evening, ladies and gentlemen,"
Calder panted, trying to catch his breath and still speak as loudly as possible.
"If you want him alive, I suggest you let us speak with the Guildheads."
Shuffles descended back to Calder's shoulder, having taken to the air during his jump.
"Want him alive,"
it echoed. A bleak wind passed over the deck, and everyone shivered. Goosebumps rose on Calder's skin, and he shook as though he saw his own death approaching. It was a nauseating feeling that made him want to run and hide and vomit all at the same time. He had sensed this before, and suddenly he wondered if he'd made a grave miscalculation. Armor clanked as General Geralis Teach marched slowly up to them, one hand on the hilt over her shoulder. Her pale, close-shaved head almost looked bald in the moonlight, and with her eyes so cold, Calder felt as though he were staring down an empress.
"Release Lord Claiborne and step back,"
Teach ordered. Calder pressed the gun harder against Nabarius' temple.
"General Teach! Excellent. It seems that you tried to have us killed, and I'd like to know what we can do to make that go away."
The general didn't twitch.
"Your death has been ordered by the future Emperor. Threatening him cannot help you."
Calder turned to Nabarius.
"I think I can get him to revoke that order. What do you think, my friend?"
"This is not wise, Captain,"
Nabarius said, unruffled. "And I'm sure allowing you to kill me and dump my body in the ocean would be the epitome of wisdom. General Teach, as you can see, I have a gun to this man's head. If you attack, I will pull the trigger. Urzaiah and I will have to fight our way out, which I'm not eager to try, but trust me when I say that I can take this entire ship down with me. I have a giant elder chained up over there, and it's not happy."
"Not happy,"
Shuffles chuckled. If anything, the general's grip tightened on her sword.
"Captain, I could kill you and your friend from here. You'd have no chance to pull the trigger or to contact your Leviathan. My guards would be in danger, but the longer this discussion goes, the more I'm reconsidering the risk."
A standoff. Calder hated standoffs. He always felt that he could talk his way out, but it somehow never worked that way. Before he could come up with any other ideas, a girl's voice piped up from behind him.
"You've forgotten me again, Geralis."
Calder pulled Nabarius back, keeping his gun in place so that he could see both General Teach and the woman who'd spoken. It was Bliss. She stood in a clear space on the deck, black coat brushing the wood, pale hair drifting behind her. Some of the guards edged away from her.
"Bliss, step away,"
the general said.
"This does not need to involve you."
Calder had another concern. "You were just aboard my ship."
"That's true."
"How did you get over here?" She unbuttoned two of her coat buttons and reached inside.
"No one likes a man who asks too many questions."
From her coat pocket, the guild head pulled a bone about the length of Calder's forearm. A chorus of ominous cackling sounded from high up in the crow's nest, as though a coven of dark spirits had started to mock him from above. In spite of himself, Calder glanced up. Nothing up there. When he returned his gaze to Bliss, the bone was a full-sized spear of one piece, its haft yellowed bone, its head flattened and sharpened. She leaned forward on the balls of her feet, holding the spear with one hand near the head and one farther back on the haft.
"Clear the deck!"
General Teach shouted.
"For your lives, get below!"
The Imperial Guard scrambled out of the way. One shaggy-furred man popped his dripping head up over the side, having climbed out of the ocean and up to the Eternal. When he heard the order, his eyes widened, and he leaped back into the sea.
"Go back to your ship, Calder Martin,"
Bliss said calmly.
"Take Nibarius Claiborne with you."
Urzaiah didn't need to hear anything else. He plucked the witness's pistols away from him, tossing them to the deck, and then threw Nibarius over his shoulder like a sack of grain. Teach bared an inch of her sword, and the force of its sheer bloodlust actually made Calder stagger backwards a step.
"Stay where you are,"
she demanded. He had to bend all his focus to close his senses, to not read, just to keep from screaming and hiding like a child. Bliss closed her eyes briefly. When she snapped them open again, they shone with a pale light. Roots twisted up from the boards as though the wood had suddenly decided to bloom. The stalks flowered into leaves, then burst into flame like a thousand candles flaring to life. The sudden heat flashed against Calder's skin. They burned with impossible speed, ash and smoke rising into the air, twisting around Bliss in a double helix. The power coming off of Bliss was, in its own way, more frightening. She radiated an eternal intent, an insatiable hunger for change, a hatred of the physical world and all its restrictive laws. If it had its way, that power would shred the rules of nature and scatter them like confetti until the world flexed and moved and changed like the sea in storm. Calder shook it off, focusing once more on keeping his senses shut. If the two guild heads clashed, death and madness meeting head-on, he wouldn't want to be anywhere inside a mile. And this was the Aeon, where unspeakable creatures were lured by power, conflict, and blood. So maybe a mile wasn't far enough. Say, 10 miles. He turned to Urzaiah. Time to leave. The Azirian didn't need to be told twice. He also didn't, as Calder had expected, immediately leap from one ship to the other. Instead, he picked up Calder and tossed him over his other shoulder. It was undignified and surprisingly painful, dangling with his face in Urzaiah's back. The man's shoulder jabbed him in the stomach like a club, and when the champion took a running start along the deck, it was like being beaten in the torso with a sack of bricks. The head of the Imperial Guard shouted after them, but they were already in the air, Shuffles laughing as it flew alongside them. Calder winced in anticipation of landing, clenching his stomach. This was going to hurt worse than any wound he had taken in the actual battle. When they landed, he found that he was right. The second void transmission caught Jerry while she slept. She woke to an icy wind and a feeling like thousands of ants crawling over her skin. Her eyes flew to the back wall, and for an instant, another pair of eyes stared straight into hers. Jerry threw a fist forward, hitting nothing, flailing like a child in the darkness. She cast her mind out to her soul-bound vessel, trying to contact her earrings. They would be in the drawer next to the bunk. But this wasn't the Testament's cabin. It was a prison cell. Her earrings remained where they always were, locked on the other side of the island, out of her reach. The eyes vanished, replaced by the familiar gaping darkness, as though the world ended in the back of her cell. If she walked back there and didn't stop, she got the feeling that she would fall off a cliff and never hit the bottom. Faint lights writhed and twisted in the shadows like tortured stars. She rolled from the bed and tried to collect herself, prepared for the voices. They were different each time. Sometimes she heard spidery whispers, but other times,
"Has the heart arrived?"
the voice roared from the void. She flinched back, hoping that no one outside the prison would hear. That could lead to awkward questions.
I'm getting along well, thank you for asking. And yes, the heart arrived just recently.
Anyone with any sensitivity to elder forces would have felt the heart the instant it landed on the island. In this case, that meant she might have been the only one to notice.
We are pleased.
A shadow whipped out within the void, snuffing out one of the drifting lights. It looked like a frog's tongue taking a fly.
Forces converge. When you feel the heart's power wax, use our gift.
Jerry glanced around her cell, but saw nothing out of the ordinary.
Gift?
Something about the size of a fist hurtled out of the void like a comet, forcing Jerry to duck. It crashed into the bars behind her with a clang of metal on metal, falling to the ground. She turned around, afraid to touch it. On closer inspection, it looked like a tight collar of braided black metal.
When the time is right, hold it and call out for help.
Jerry brushed the back of her fingers across the dark metal, testing it. It was such a bitter cold that it stung her skin, but she'd heard that was normal for objects transferred through the void. She tucked it into a corner of her blankets, hoping it would warm up with time.
Will this free me?
She asked.
Potentially.
The void began to shrink back into itself, dragging the unnatural chill with it.
Wait for the power of the mother's heart. Wait.
Then the void finally closed to one black point and winked away. After she had collected herself, Jerry called out,
I expect you heard that.
I can't believe the guards haven't shown up already,
Lucan responded from the other side of the wall.
I expect the voice only sounded loud to us, she said. Out of this room, they would have likely heard nothing.
That makes no sense. If a voice sounds loud to us, then it's loud to everyone.
Though he couldn't see it, she smiled into the darkness of her cell.
Only one of the many mysteries the elders have shared with us. Imagine if our readers could craft messages that only certain people could hear.
That doesn't appear to be the case,
he pointed out.
I could hear most of it clearly. If you could tailor it to a specific listener, then why didn't they make it so that only you could hear the message? Or did they specify a radius?
Lucan trailed off, murmuring to himself. That was fine with her. She left him to it. Her own father had taken advantage of her curiosity to induct her into the Sleepless in the first place, and if she could pique the interest of a few others, then she would have repaid him well, especially if one of those others was a consultant. She laid back on her cot, but her mind rushed too fast to let her get back to sleep. What would happen if she tried to use the gift now? Would it do nothing, or would it allow her to break free and fail to fulfill whatever purpose the Sleepless had intended? Shouldn't she test it? What if she needed to use it at the appropriate time, but it didn't work? More importantly, when would the heart's power rise? If it wasn't in the next day or two, then the consultants would inevitably find the black metal stashed in her blankets. They didn't inspect her possessions every day, but when they did, they were surprisingly thorough. She had hidden a few innocuous items, a handful of splinters from her meal tray, a napkin, the broken tine of a fork, all over her cell, just to test, and they were always gone after inspection. There was no way she could hide something as obvious as the iron gift for long. After a few minutes, Lucan called her name.
Jairine, something's coming. Do not say a word. You won't hear anything, but your life may be in danger. Are you communing with the elders?
Not a word, I said. This is bad. She may kill you on principle.
Who?
Quiet, she's here.
Jerry heard nothing, but she felt another wave of cold crawl over her skin. This wasn't the same sharp, bitter cold as the void transmission, but the clammy, shivering cold of lifeless flesh. She felt it in her mind, in her connection to the elders that she'd had since she was a little girl. It was cold loneliness, followed by the warm promise of rebirth. The heart of the dead mother. It was coming here. As they traveled toward the Gray Island, they kept Nabarius gagged and tied to the mast. Calder found it very entertaining, though Andal didn't approve and Petal kept a safe distance. It didn't pay off in anything except personal satisfaction until the second day, when a column of slate-gray cloud appeared on the horizon. It looked almost like a hurricane locked into place, a swirling wall of dark gray fog and cloud, raised like a barrier between them and the rest of the sea. After years of sailing the Aeon, he'd never seen anything like it. "What is that?" he asked no one in particular. Surprisingly, it was Petal who answered, inching her way closer to him as she spoke.
That's the Grey Island. It's why they call it that. Grey, I mean. It's a wall of mist, or maybe fog, and it stays up all year round. Surrounds the whole island. Nobody knows how it was done, and some alchemists, in the guild, I mean, some alchemists try to duplicate it in their labs, and they can't."
Having said her piece, Petal scurried off. The Grey Island. It was impressive, he had to admit. Not the most intimidating supernatural sight he'd seen on this sea, but certainly worth a visit. Now, what is it for, I wonder? The consultants had never tried to hide the island's location. Calder had never been himself, but he'd spoken to those who had visited their headquarters. The guild would invite anyone with enough marks to their island any time of year. Some chapter houses handed out free maps. So, what did all that mist actually accomplish? He was still at the wheel when he saw Nabarius' eyes snap open, staring straight at the Grey Island. The witness shot to his feet, lunging in that direction. Calder hopped down from the stern deck and made his way over, reaching out a hand to read the chronicler. As soon as he sensed the cold, clammy influence on the man, he moved his hand back.
"That song!" Nabarius cried. "Do you hear the song?"
No doubt. Nabarius sensed the heart of the dead mother.
"All hands on deck," Calder shouted.
Andal spoke up from the nearby folding table, where he was idly shuffling cards.
"We're all here, sir."
"What have I told you about shouting, Andal?"
"That you like it."
"That's right. Don't take that from me."
The others gathered around Andal. Foster hopped down from the mast, Petal scurried up and sat on a crate nearby, and a distracted-looking Urzaya looked toward the horizon and fiddled with his hatchet.
"Where is she?" Calder asked the cook.
Urzaya pointed straight to the island.
"Naturally," Calder muttered.
Andal clapped his hands together.
"All right, everyone. Let the 23rd official crew meeting begin."
Calder sighed, pulling up a folding camp chair to the table. "I was hoping we could talk off the record, Andal."
"Rejected,"
Andal said.
"Foster, take notes."
Foster grumbled under his breath as he switched out his shooting glasses for reading glasses. Petal handed him a pen and a sheet of paper.
"Please describe the situation for the record, Captain."
Calder couldn't see why they didn't just talk about it. He never consulted these logs for anything. But Andal enjoyed the formality, and it wasn't worth fighting about. "Nabarius has sensed the heart. It's clearly in that direction, which is the approximate location of the consultant's Grey Island. And now Urzaya feels the blonde consultant, Sheriff's partner, in that location. Isn't that right, Urzaya?" He drew in a deep breath through his nose.
"I can smell her from here."
Petal shivered and edged away from him.
"So,"
Andal began, but Foster stopped him.
"Give me a second. I'm not a chronicler. I can't write that fast. I don't see why we can't get Nabarius to take notes."
"Really?"
Andal said.
"You really can't see why?"
Foster grumbled for a few more seconds until he finally caught up to the conversation. Andal waited for his nod to continue.
"We're in deep water here. This affects everyone, so we'd like to hear all opinions. Petal."
As much as Calder hated to take the time it took to consult the crowd, he had to admit that his quartermaster was right. Landing on the Grey Island would affect everyone on the ship, for better or worse, and it would be best if everyone was willing to walk forward with their eyes wide open. He decided to act as though he had supported the idea from the beginning. Petal cleared her throat, fiddling with a bottled potion and peering out from under her hair.
"Well, I think we should at least try to get the heart. Ourselves. The consultants will destroy it, right? That's probably not good. I want there to be an emperor, but I don't want it to be Nabarius, so..."
She shrunk into herself, apparently finished. Calder was proud of her. That was the most she'd expressed herself all year.
"Well said, Petal."
Andal pointed to Urzaya, who shrugged.
The consultant women owe me a fight. I will be collecting. That is all.
Simple, Calder said. Easy to remember. I like that philosophy. When Foster had finally finished writing, Andal turned to him.
And what do you think, Foster?
Dalton Foster raised shaggy eyebrows.
Me? I think we should let the consultants destroy the thing. It hasn't done us any good.
If they actually will, Calder pointed out. It still seemed strange to him that the consultants would go through such efforts to retrieve the heart if they meant to destroy it when they got it back home.
My turn,
Andal said, folding his arms.
I think we're in way over our heads.
Foster scribbled his words on the paper.
Good. Means we're in familiar waters.
I also think that it will take more than the usual amount of effort to get any pay out of this.
That was a good point. Of course, they still had Nabarius. Maybe they could arrange some kind of a ransom, and then escape alive to spend it. That was the trick.
However,
Andal went on,
I do think we need to make it to the island. We're in too deep to back out now, and I know we'd all like to settle once and for all what happened to Jyreen.
Calder had been trying to avoid thinking of Jerry ever since the gray island appeared in the distance, though it was all but impossible. His wife could be on that island, or perhaps her corpse was buried there. Either way, he needed to find out. He realized that the others were staring at him, so he picked up the discussion. I don't trust Nabarius. I don't trust his sponsors, and I certainly don't trust the consultants. If it weren't for Jerry, I would want to sail as far away from this island as possible and never look back. But if there's a chance she's alive... The others didn't move, waiting for him to finish. I have to know. But I would like to escape the island and get home alive. For that purpose, I believe the heart is indispensable. He turned his gaze to Nabarius. We need something to trade for our freedom, and I don't think anything less than the heart of Nekothi will keep us out of the gallows. Everyone remained silent. Andal returned to shuffling his cards, which he often did simply to keep his hands occupied. After a few moments, Andal fanned out a hand of cards, watching Calder over the tops.
It seems to me that we need advice.
That's why I keep you around, Calder said.
You might say that we need someone to consult.
A new possibility opened up before him. He'd been overthinking everything. I am a little ashamed I never thought of that. Well played, Andal. He hopped up from the table and hurried back to the stern deck, already adjusting the ship's position with his intent. Foster muttered to himself as he wrote,
Captain jumps to a conclusion. There, meeting adjourned.
1 second, sir, Andal said. As soon as we set foot on the island, we'll be in their hands. What do we have to deal with an army of consultants?
Calder stopped, spinning to grin at his quartermaster.
Nothing. If they decide to kill us, they'll kill us. There comes a time when you must play the odds, Mr. Patronus.
Andal cleared his throat and stared pointedly at the door to Calder's cabin.
If only we had some sort of device that would protect us from hundreds of loyal Imperial citizens sworn to protect and obey.
Calder realized what Andal was getting at, and his smile slipped. He had intended to save that for a distant, ideal future. He had begun to think, recently, that he would never open the lockbox again. He steeled himself. As the Isirian strategist Yenzir once said, the winner is the one who first recognizes that the time for a battle has come.
That's two ideas you've had now, Calder said. I like the first one better.
It's a risk, but I would say the time has come.
Andal gestured to the cabin.
Go get it, Captain. Then let's hire a consultant.
Calder pushed his way into the cabin, opening the drawer beside his bunk. He withdrew a small silver key invested with his intent. If anyone other than him picked up the key, they would feel a crippling pain in their hand. He grabbed the key, reached under his bunk, and pulled out the lockbox. He kept it chained to the bottom of the bunk so it didn't slide around, but he had enough slack to insert the key. If Jerry was still alive, she had better appreciate this. Chapter 19. I hear that you have awakened your mother's stand mirror. Upon hearing of its effects, I urged her to have the device melted down and to hire a Luminian pilgrim to cleanse its remnants. Let me emphasize once again the dangers of awakening, as clearly my previous correspondence was not effective. Hypothetically, let us say that you tried to awaken a mirror that once, unbeknownst to you, hung in the dungeon of a notorious murderer. Every day, his victims looked into the mirror and wished to be saved. Would it not be likely that the mirror would save a measure of their desperate intent? And when awakened, that very mirror might cry out for salvation. Why, it might do anything to be free, including distorting the minds and senses of those nearby. Of course, we are speaking in the hypothetical sense. Arthur Belfry, Imperial Witness, taken from a letter to his pupil 2 months after the previous message was delivered. 11 years ago.
It's supposed to be a ship for the navigators, Calder explained. We're going to summon some sort of elder creature from the Aeon, and it will guide the crew across the sea. With an elder chained to the ship, the other elder spawn won't bother them, and they'll be able to make the voyage in half the time. That's the idea, anyway.
Jirene chewed on the end of her pen.
But will it sail?
It doesn't matter if it will sail. We won't be on board. We can't crew a ship with 2 people.
3 once we have your father.
Oh, I forgot. 3 is precisely the number we need. I'll pilot, you navigate, and my father can man the rest of the ship.
Jerry threw the pen at him. It bounced off his head and hurt far more than he felt was fair. Calder yelped, and something scurried around them. They froze. Jerry threw her scarf over the tiny quick lamp on the center of the table. They were holed up in the Greyweather House library under cover of night. Jirene had returned to her family home several hours before, sneaking back here to plan what she called their clandestine operation. She and Calder sat on opposite ends of a small table, papers stacked in neat piles on its surface. Shadows smothered the rest of the room, leaving them in a pool of yellow light, at least when their quick lamp was shining. Smothered by Jerry's scarf, the illumination cast them in dull orange, weaker than a candle flame. They froze just long enough to make sure that no one had cracked the door to the library, and then Jirene pulled the scarf back and they both sat down. Calder continued as if nothing had happened.
I'm sorry, but it really wouldn't work. They've prepared most of the ship, because it's supposed to go on display next week, but there aren't any sails.
He had been sure they would add sails by now. He was no shipwright, but surely if the rest of the ship was ready to display, they could tack up some sails.
Maybe it doesn't need sails,
Jerry said, undeterred.
If this elder is supposed to pull the testament, then what are the sails for?
Calder had been the one to invest the mast so that it properly flexed against the tug of a full sail, but there was a better reason why Jerry's plan wouldn't work.
They haven't summoned it yet,
he said.
There's been an issue with the tidal forces or something.
He'd heard the other watchmen discussing it just that morning in worried tones. The specific creature they sought hadn't wandered close enough to shore by now, which probably meant it had fallen under the purview of a great elder. And no one wanted to risk incurring the wrath of a great elder, even one that had remained dead for over 1,000 years, so far. He shook his head, clearing it.
Why were they talking about the ship? Anyway, that's enough about the ship. The ship won't work. There is no ship.
Jerry worked her jaws as though chewing on something, but she ultimately calmed herself by rubbing a thumb over the tattoos on the back of her left hand.
That leaves my other plan, then.
She reached into the stack of papers and pulled one out, seemingly at random. Across the top of the page, in block letters, she'd printed the name of this plan. Operation Jirene Does Calder's Job. Jirene disguises herself in Calder's Black Watch uniform. Using her superior skills of thespianism and persuasion, Jirene convinces the staff of an elder-related emergency. She will follow this supposed elder spawn to the very door of Roderick Martin's cell, thus insisting that it needs to be opened. Remember, Calder, there will not actually be an elder spawn present. Do not be afraid, as Jirene will protect you. With her authority as the Black Watch, she will take Roderick into custody, suspecting that the elders have corrupted him. Should the guards resist, Jirene will subdue them with her legendary combat prowess. When she returns with Roderick Martin in tow, Calder will bow before her, kissing her feet and singing her praises to the heavens as she rightly deserves. At the bottom of the paper, she had signed her name with far more loops and flourishes than were strictly necessary.
I tried to boil the steps down to their essence, for simplicity's sake,
Jerry said, with a straight face.
There are some issues unaccounted for, but a good plan must allow for freedom of improvisation.
Calder sputtered for a moment before he managed to say,
You know this is ridiculous. Jyreen lifted the paper and briefly scanned it.
No, I'd say that everything is in order.
First of all, if there's not an Elder Spawn present, why would you need to protect me?
That's the first thing you object to, is it?
That and the name. Other than that...
Calder swallowed his pride and distaste, nodding to the paper.
In essence, I have to admit, this could work.
She looked up, surprised.
I wrote this so that I could see you turn red.
Well, it needs some fleshing out, but it's not a bad idea. I could do without the repeated insults to my person, though.
I find those aspects of this plan indispensable.
He leaned over, tracing the third step of the plan with his index finger.
From what I can tell, the receptionist will respond only as her superiors tell her to. That involves calling security in the event of an emergency. A member of the Black Watch saying there's an elder loose in the building surely constitutes an emergency.
Won't we need more proof?
Jerry asked. Calder shrugged.
What signs come along with the invasion of an elder?
I don't know. Screaming? Creeping shadows? Spoiling milk?
No one knows.
If there was anything he'd learned from his few months in the Black Watch, it was that each elder spawn was different. Some of the watchmen complained about how their quarry was impossible to track, and others that the elder spawn's shrieks had woken everyone within 3 city blocks.
There's no predicting the way an unknown elder or elder spawn will behave. Most people have to take the word of the Black Watch that there's an elder involved at all.
She shook the end of her pen in his direction.
If you keep talking like that, I might mistake you for a real watchman.
He shuddered, thinking of Bliss.
Not yet, I'm not. But if you're wearing a watchman's coat and badge, they should take your word for the emergency. That's all, though. They shouldn't release any prisoners or do anything else without an official order from the guild or actual proof of an elder attack.
Then how do we get the cell door open?
Jerry asked.
Do we steal a key? Or can you invest something that will help?
Calder took a deep breath. He had been prepared for this when he came here, but he couldn't help thinking that he was taking a terrible risk. First, he covered his fingers in a handkerchief. Then he reached into his shirt pocket and pulled out the Emperor's key.
I won't have to.
Skepticism was painted across Jyreen's expression.
That's it? Will it fit the lock?
It doesn't have to. One tap and it will undo any lock that can be opened by a key.
The skepticism faded, but her reaction was still less than Calder had hoped for.
Oh, really? Okay, that's one problem solved. But how are we going to get him out of the building?
He stood, with the key outstretched in his hand, feeling foolish.
This is a valuable artifact.
It sounds very impressive, but I would expect no less out of a reader of your skill.
He had nothing to do with investing this key, but he felt better anyway.
I know you're patronizing me, he said, but I still accept flattery.
He placed the key down on the table.
Now, how are we going to get him out of the building?
Just a moment. If we're going to rewrite the plan, then I need to take notes.
She pulled a blank sheet of paper out of the pile and began to write a title across the top.
How about Operation Calder Does Nothing?
The next morning, Calder rose early. He buttoned up his Black Watch coat, pinned on his badge, and brushed his hair before walking downstairs for breakfast. He had to ensure that everyone down at the dock saw him at work, acting as if everything was still normal. Tonight, he would break his father out of prison. The dining room was all but empty. No Arthur and Voris, no servants carrying dishes. The table wasn't set. Only Alsa stood with her back to the door, hurriedly dropping a sheet over something that looked like